www.alternativeradio.org. Coming up on CKOT is...
L'alerte de votre région ou d'une région à proximité est rouge. Afin de limiter la propagation de la COVID-19, les rassemblements d'amis ou de familles dans les résidences et cours privées sont interdits. Les déplacements entre régions sont à éviter et les déplacements vers les zones jaunes sont interdits. De plus, il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 20h et 5h le matin. Visitez québec.ca/coronavirus pour connaître les mesures en place. Respectez toutes les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Good evening and welcome to the April 22nd edition of Droma Text. Tonight we have a one-hour presentation of the Nobel Prize winning author's work, Woolly Soyinka. It's a reading of his poems entitled Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1986, the first African to receive the prize. He's an author of an extraordinarily large number of books, comedies, philosophy, plays, and literary criticism. And so here we'll hear tonight Soyinka reading from his work, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known. Here he is, Woolly Soyinka.
Last time I was asked to introduce Woolly Soyinka, some man in the audience told me afterwards, I think I liked some of the things you said, but you were there for too long. So I tried to avoid doing that by putting down my introduction so as to discipline myself. Elsewhere, if Woolly Soyinka was to be introduced, horns would be blaring and drums would be roaring, and Riki poets whose tongues are washed by the gods.
Yeah, we had that, but now,
I have to avoid all of that, and in sedate and sober Harvard, I have to do it this way. I am honored to have the opportunity to welcome my longtime friend and compatriot. We are both from good old Nigeria, Woolly Soyinka, back to W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. Today, we will have the privilege of hearing him read from his new collection of poetry, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known. Woolly Soyinka is Africa's most acclaimed writer. In 1986, he became the first African to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. His writing is as much about the complexities of the human condition as it is about the political turmoil in his native Nigeria. From satirical comedy to serious philosophy, Soyinka writes with equal power as a dramatist, poet, and as a novelist. The New York Times Book Review has called his autobiographical work a classic of African autobiography, indeed a classic of childhood memoirs, wherever and whenever produced. About another of his books, The Open Sore of a Continent, a personal narrative of the Nigerian crisis, published in 1997, the Christian Science Monitor had this to say: the trio of essays is passionate, stirring, and chock full of humor and insight. Its theme, whether the nation state, is among the most compelling topics in sub-Saharan Africa and throughout the post-Cold War world. Martin Esling, you all know, has called Soyinka one of the finest poetic playwrights who have ever written in English. And the Irish Times simply called him a writer of genius. These are just random selections. But if you read around, you find that there's so much that has been said about him. Soyinka's 1975 play, Death and the King's Husband, remains his most widely read and performed work. Among his other many notable publications are A Play of Giants, published in 1984, the novel The Interpreters, published in 1965, and the autobiographical works Ake, The Years of Childhood, and The Man Died, Prison Notes, published in 1972. This latter work, The Man Died, is an account of his 22 months as a political prisoner in the late 1960s, when he was incarcerated by the Nigerian government during the Civil War. His most recent collection of poetry, which I mentioned earlier, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known, was written during a period of exile from Nigeria and was just published last month. Altogether, he's published more than 20 books. These are the official books. They're not the sideline incidental publications. You would be counting in the hundreds. But I'm just the mainline publications, the ones I'm talking about. Now, Soyinka was born in 1934 in Abeokuta, near Ibadan. Abeokuta is the capital of Ogun State in Nigeria, Western Nigeria. His father was headmaster of the Anglican Mission School in the village of Ake, and it was here that Soyinka received his first education, which juxtaposed early Christian training and schooling in traditional Yoruba beliefs and practices. He went on to study at the Government College in Ibadan and then at the University of Leeds, from which he earned a doctoral degree in 1973. From the 1960s on, Soyinka has taught drama and literature at universities in Ibadan, Lagos, and Ife, and he has held a number of visiting professorships in Europe and the United States at institutions including Cambridge University and Yale University. He is currently the Robert W. Woodruff Professor of the Arts at Emory University in Atlanta. In 1995, Wole Soyinka delivered the Du Bois Institute's inaugural Macmillan Stewart Lectures, which were co-sponsored by Oxford University Press. I am also delighted to say that in academic year 1995-1996, Soyinka was a fellow here at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. In 1999, he was named the first distinguished scholar in residence by New York University's Africana Studies and the Institute of African American Affairs. Please join me in welcoming here Wole Soyinka.
Thank you very much. I didn't know a man could be so easily terrorized. Because I was present at that famous, sorry, famous introduction. He was arriving at the so only to find there was still a coda. see that this time he wasn't taking any chances at all. But thanks, Iman. As you see, he's very objective. One or two corrections, and I have to say this each time, because I live in a country where it doesn't matter who says what, it eventually comes back to you as having said it. I didn't earn a doctorate from Leeds University. I dropped out after my first degree and hung out in the theatres in London. And eventually Leeds University called me back and gave me an honorary doctorate. So, which is very different from sweating it out like others did. One or two other tiny details which I'll deal with you later on. But this one is most important that I announce it in the open so I can say there are witnesses. I never said. Anyway, it says on the program to read from and discuss his new latest publication. I know it has not been published in the United States, although there are copies, pirated, I'm sure, floating around. Did I mention any names?
No,
I didn't mention any names. I decided to read from this new publication for the simple reason that it's a theme which has been obsessing me. This is a volume of poems in which the majority of the poems really deal with a theme which has become a critical one in our times. And that, to just state it at its most simplistic, is tolerance, extremism. You know, the extremism of ideology, of faith, leading to the most unbelievable, irrational conflicts all over the world. Du Bois said in his time that the problem of the 20th century would be one of race. And he was right. Borrowing from him, I did say, even before we embarked on this new century in Paris, that I felt that the problem of the next century would be one of religious intolerance. And sure enough, a few months after I said that, the first fatwa, international fatwa, was issued against the fellow writer, Salman Rushdie. I'm not trying to say I'm prophetic, I'm just saying that I just looked at the entrails of the latest bush fowl I killed, and I could read very clearly. It's so clear, and that's what we're all undergoing today. You know, fundamentalisms of all kinds, whether from Osama bin Laden or his running mate George Bush. It's all this fundamentalist streak has overtaken all of us, and. And the timing of this anthology for me is just perfect. I'll be reading from Samarkand. This is the English publication, but one of the main poem there, which is Samarkand, I'll be reading from this elegant volume, which does honor to literature everywhere. There are people, you know, who are still primitive enough to believe in bookcraft, and they print these things handcrafted, specially designed. And believe me, it's the poem looks different when you look at it in this kind of special binding with illustrations. It just makes you want to go on writing some more poetry. So the two things feed from each other. I should tell you that the proceeds from this special edition called Rainmaker Editions actually go towards the establishment and the maintenance of Cities of Asylum network all over the world for persecuted writers, which again has become one of the problems of our times. It's very expensive. I can't even afford one. I'm entitled to just one copy. Some people wanted to snitch this copy, but I had to tell them very firmly that it's my only copy. That's all I'm entitled to. I didn't look anywhere. I'm going to begin, in fact, but at the same time, I want this election to be one of celebration. Why? Simply because, as I was saying the other day in Las Vegas, that I've been feeling rather depressed lately. by what's been happening in certain other parts of the world. You also must have felt the shock when you learned of a library being burnt, and an ancient library as that in Baghdad. It's for me a disaster. One even feels guilty, and Skip and I were discussing this, one feels guilty when one admits that somehow it shocks you more than the killing of innocent civilians. I think maybe because we're all aware of mortality, and we know that certain things are supposed to outlast us, outlast human beings. So when you hear of a museum being destroyed, looted, and a library being set on fire, you really feel something's been taken out of you personally, out of your life, even though you've never been there before. I think most people, you know, who in the arts or creative, or who are sensitive in any way, feel that. And so the selection which I have is a selection of celebration simply because one has to try and transcend these moments of negativity. And so I'll be reading Samarkand, which deals with, intolerance and alternative views of existence away from rigid ideologies of either the secular or the theocratic kind, which for me is a statement of defiance against the Philistinism, which is overtaking us today, statement that there are still things left to celebrate. And in fact, the very act of literature, of publication, of fine arts books and so on, is a kind of symbolic resistance to these negative events which overtake us. But let me begin with one which is not all that celebrative, just to remind us of where we are today. And I selected this. It's entitled, Where the News Came to Me of the Death of a Tyrant. Where the News Came to Me of the Death of a Tyrant. And the news came to me of the death of this tyrant, actually, in Jerusalem. That was my first ever visit there. And I stood on the Mount of Olives, also called the Noble Sanctuary by in the Islamic world. And that's when I heard the news that what had been driving me all over the world had finally been removed. And I wondered why the same solution could not take place in some form or the other on this beautiful land, which really is a moving piece of real estate in which the whole red lens of spirituality hits you, whether you believe in one religion or the other. It's something about standing on the tip of the Noble Sanctuary. Where the news came to me of the death of a tyrant. Dusk on Mount of Olives, Noble Sanctuary. I stood, medium of a nation's darkest hour, stranger as so many feet to a sea land peopled also by strangers. Journeys shared on legendary paths, epic wells, patriarch cemeteries, rites, reliquaries, and holy sanctuaries. Bound at navel, yet strangers sworn to sword. Mine also was the darkest hour of a distant land. No wonder the sinuous plains, far as eyes or mind could capture, ruptured suddenly, filled with sparks of scythe-hopped chariots, impassioned lances, froth-lipped horses in the charge of death, riders, salvation bound in one last holy carnage. The ghosts of old delusions, potent still, reveled in invocation of the sacred word. A time stood still for this birthland of millennia. A blindfold wider than nations and more craved stretched, it seemed, across spires and domes, cross and crescent, toned in the golden haze of dusk, snaked through bronze warrens, spice and leather alleys, date trestles, sandalwood, olive groves and sparse oases, wound through catacombs where piety, praise and wounds. Yet the air was peace, palpable to touch, an eternal presence like a set transparency masking the face of gore, a resolution glimpsed through palimpsests of blood-stained suns. A gift, it proved, a resolution dearly sought. Strife brought me to a warring land where olives detonate in shrapnels, shrivel as infant heads. Hope is split on the axe of history, zeal and politics. Yet one road only leads to Jerusalem, only one, that broad, pebbled spine of human oneness. Pondering war, I trod the sandal-paved stones, senses lulled in light incense, brushed by hems of ropes from distant sages, pilgrims of all faiths, and the dark hour beckoned to me in hope. From that seared land that I had sworn I would not leave with empty hands came a gift and a choice to amplify or squander. One tyrant less may spell little, but who scorns the miser's dole of respite, a drop of manna from skies of that same miracle land? One drum of war, at least, was muted. This gift lies heavy on my hands, unrequited. Would I could stay the glimpse of that rare moment when the shrouds of history parted and a vision of hope suffused the plains of the Mount of Olives, noble sanctuary. I move now to celebrate the poem itself, the process of creativity, sort of, because not really to celebrate, but to talk about lost creative pieces. That should be in this chapter. Sorry, information. Those of you who write as you must from time to time have wondered where a poem you scribbled yesterday disappeared to. And maybe a year later you find scraps of it, and then you wonder what was the rest about? Where is the rest? And so to console myself, because I lose poems the way I lose keys and pens. So to console myself, I decided to write a poem to lost poems. I think sometimes of poems I have lost. Maybe their loss it was that saved the world. Still, they do get lost. And I recall them only when a fragment levitates behind discarded invoices, the black-rimmed notice of a last goodbye, a birth, a wedding invitation, and other milestones of a lesser kind. The moment torments, why? Beyond an instant's passion, dubious flash, Satori in a bar, taxi or restaurant, an airport waiting lounge, that births the scribble on a stained napkin? What cast of the ephemeral once resonates, then spurns the mind the morning after? All that survives mimics a wrinkled petal pressed between pages of a long discarded book. A falling leaf trapped briefly by the passing sun, it flashes a mere shard of memory, but filled with wistful accusations of abandonment. Too late, no life to it. The book is closed, the moment's exaltation or despair drowned in wine rivers, shriveled in suns of greater wars. I turn these scrapbooks of a moment's truth to cinders, curlings curse in smoke, once more fugitive beyond recall of usurper's summons by the morning after. I think of voices I have lost and touches, the fleeting brush of eyes that burrows deep within the heart of need, the pledge unspoken, the more than acts of faith that forge an instant world in silent pact with strangers, deeper, deeper bonds than the dearest love's embrace. And now, let's celebrate food. This poem is dedicated to a friend of mine, late now. Skip knows him, met him. He taught me food. I just used to think that food was something you ate to keep alive, but he was different. When Femi ate in a restaurant, people left their plates to stare at him. Then we'll walk across to shake his hand and sometimes buy him drinks. I mean, he ate with such, I mean, he gave meaning to food. And sometimes I would go out with him in a restaurant. I wouldn't eat because I was watching him all the time. And I would be filled just by watching him. So he taught me to appreciate food. In return, I taught him wine. Business lunch, the bag lady for Femi Johnson. It was an afternoon of indifferent news. The world was still, the world was turbid, the Dow Jones index fell several points or rose to a Wall Street dance. All trading leads to bankruptcy or wealth, and there an end. The babble of striped suits launching on expense account left him cold. He only wished his host had chosen differently, feeling lost among the tinkle of glass cubes in iced teas, gurgle of predictable Chardonnay. I have to return to work, well, just another, and the sudden welt of laughter that somehow traced the downward spiral of some absent victim, a hollow victory, or simply a dirty joke. Suddenly, one false note among the staid discordants, a rogue painting lone in the gallery of fakes, ignored, a highlight through the stain of laughters that sought refuge in rendition of the intruder as invisible, barely spied through opacities of bonhomie, joie de vivre. Beneath the false banter, now, what has this place become? I did not see her enter. So still, her gaze implacably wound in thought, yet a laser beam through the noon window. Not quite a tramp, and yet a misfit in her bulbous wrap. A handbag held her secrets, safe in line of vision on the tabletop, to a micro-world of her mobile home without, a shopping cart piled high with a lifetime foraging. Does she feel eyes and shuffling feet and swiveling heads, arrested martinis midway to genteel throats? She does not fidget. No Morse code filters through her feet, cased in soft leather ease to read impatience. An ankle of white socks beneath stovepipe jeans, faded or distressed, she waited. Angle feet, anxiety deprived, mildly wrapped around the table's stem, affirmed her equipoise. Not comfort-seeking, it is just her way of sitting, limbs that find and nuzzle those of a now familiar lover. Awesomely at ease, oblivious to the inner room on which her back was turned, unperturbed by the kaleidoscope without, does she know the Labrador on leash, hind leg raised in wet salute against a cage sapling? Her pebble lenses yield no clue. Her gaze is innocence itself, and when the waiter bends a practiced ear, a face concealing no surprise, her order is precise, assured. As grew the demolition when the rack of lobsters came, and tabula rasa turned a rapturous field in one transcendent flash, then came the love affair. A tease, a foreplay, a realignment of limbs and mock passes with steel nutcrackers over prostrate yet aggressive curvatures. When it came, the crunch was massive. As the silence drawn in turned heads and suspended gestures, eyes turned to floundering fish, then claw by claw she tamed the rash crustacean, probed deep crevices for virgin flesh, teased out sleek slivers inaccessible till then. The dainty prong between her fingers was a tuning fork. And thus it was that sounds of breaking surf overwhelmed a beach of loud sun worshippers. A diviner's stick that blunted the arid carpers for unsuspected spurts of moisture, liposuctions coming fast but moderated, a narrative of barnacles and limpets, deep sea odysseys, and Neptune's trident playfully at work in lyric fingers. Her face, a surgeon's mask, still soft, an infinite capacity for care and skill sufficiency now assumed the lobster's ruddy glow. Gently, as a beaching craft, she coasted home. Her legs released the prisoner's stem, hands fell away from conquered plates, heaped shards of shell self-surmounting in their cream and prickle-red submission. It was plain she too had come for business. It was an afternoon of indifferent news. The world was still, the world was turbid. I had great need of a universe that still was peopled, lived, loved, and died, ate and defecated, wrapped its legs around the table's stem. The Labrador on leash returned without a glance at its pliant urinal. Two nursemaids paused by the window, laughed and gossiped as in a silent film. I turned inwards to a room filled suddenly with mouths and throats, enthralled to food as sometime function, saw my face reflected in the wall-length mirror. Chastened now, I gulped my tepid glass of Chardonnay. And in Yoruba tradition, and as well as in many African traditions, all performers salute either their instruments before they even perform, or their ancestors, forebears, their mentors, parts of their body, their skills, etc., etc. So I'm going to salute, do a little bit of this salutation with a salute to my eyes. The title is Doctored Vision. Have you heard that one before?
No.
No. Submissive to the year's constraints, the poet tries again the optician's expertise. The placard test begins. One eye obeys all semiotic tests. The other blurs the dots, rapes simple arithmetic. The mind can only total what it separates, but spots the gnat slow crawling on the lens's eye. Next, the literacy test. We'll try this board, shall we? Start with the topmost line. The errant eye discerns, at best, a charming alphabestiary. K flaunts wings, R wags a furry tail, H sprouts horns, F is unicorn. Rabbit ears adorn the simple U, while others droop from W. C has long closed ranks. He thinks of flawed O-rings. Am I doomed to crash from vault in vision? The left eye, boastful, reads in sync the micro-printing on the bottom line, but finds the page close-held, a mindless hieroglyphic smear. The doctor frowns, tugs at his lower lip. His scrutiny suggests a catch. They are both your eyes. I know of no eye transplant in entirety. His sigh is terminal. He tells the poet what other clinics had long diagnosed. Short-sighted in one eye, long on the other. The patient waits. The explosion comes on cue, but not within the limits we call natural. A little difference, that's the norm. But these, sir, belong to different pairs of eyes. Shrunken shanks, hoary head, will I look cute in monocle? The poet plans, he hopes, a veto on the optician's line of thought. I hate bifocals. The doctor's laugh is bitter. Your case, sir, goes beyond bifocal remedy. Christ, you think I spend 3 hours on every client with eyes like yours? No one could stay in business. A squint would make some sense, because your eyes, sir, are at war with one another. They harmonize at certain magic intervals. Don't ask me how. They are your eyes, not mine, or so you claim. A sharp, derisive snort affirms the doubt. Magic intervals. The patient...